The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle, stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Schools are opening in Georgia, but the often emotional debate about whether and how to do it safely is already well underway. And the toll in COVID-19 cases, rates of positive tests, and deaths continues to rise. Governor Kemp signs a controversial police protection bill, and while President Trump trashes mail-in absentee voting, except in Florida, of course, there's a growing dispute between the state's top elections official and one Atlanta-area county. But we are indisputably delighted that you're here for the Political Breakfast. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Republican strategist Brian Robinson and Democratic strategist Theron Johnson are back. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, Dennis.
Good to be here with you, Dennis.
Let's start with school openings and the safety decisions that districts have to make. Cherokee County had to quarantine an entire second grade class after a student tested positive for coronavirus. Five Marietta City Schools employees tested positive. On the first day of school in Paulding County, a photo posted on social media showed jam hallways, hardly any masks in sight. That went viral. And the state's largest school system, Gwinnett County, had 260 of its employees either test positive or go into quarantine after they had possibly been exposed. Brian, this is all happening as the state's percentage of positive tests on a seven-day moving average is at nearly 13%. That's 10th highest in the nation. Still, Governor Brian Kemp, as we speak at least, is standing by his statement he wants kids in classrooms. Given that health professionals say the ideal percentage positive rate is 5%, isn't the governor playing with fire here?
I think we'll have a really good idea in 2 to 3 weeks. I think I say that every week. We'll have a really good idea in 2 to 3 weeks. Because I do think we've moved into a new phase now that kids are back in school. There are a lot of unknowns. You know, the president made news this week when he said that kids don't get the disease or transmit it. Of course, Facebook and Twitter took down those statements, which is
because
just
they were false. He said their kids are practically immune, and they're not practically immune.
So it's just going to be another political divide on these things, regardless of what the facts are, and I don't know what they are. But I did see this week the photos of high schoolers going back to class, walking down crowded hallways, taking class photos together, shoulder to shoulder with no one wearing masks. And look, I think that when it comes to a school scenario, we're not talking about mandating that people in their normal lives, walking down the street, wearing masks. This is about a situation where people are by design put in together indoors, where we know the risk of transmission is much higher. And it doesn't seem that many of these teenagers are taking it very seriously. Now, that shouldn't surprise any of us. We were all teenagers once. But if those behaviors continue, I do predict we're going to have even bigger problems. I think that transmission rate, that infection rate is going to go up even higher. And I don't think the same principles apply as what Governor Kemp has been talking about. The law is very clear that when it comes to kids in school, their freedoms are on a different scale than what they are for adults. They do have to conform to certain guidelines, whether it's dress codes, language, behavior. And I think this is one of those situations where schools are going to have to mandate masks. As listeners know, I am all in favor of us opening back up. I want kids to go back to school. I think it's critically important to their development and for our economy, but we've got to be responsible. That's always been the flip side of what I said. We've got to be responsible. And I'm looking at photos showing that too many people aren't.
Let's just pause for a second, Dennis, and realize what you just said. A second grader and this second grader's classroom had to quarantine because this second grader tested positive for coronavirus. Did we ever think that we would say that in Georgia? To put everyone back in a classroom, back in a school, it's just really, really risky. And listen, no one loves virtual learning, not teachers, not students, not parents, but it is what we should be doing to stop the spread and flatten the curve. I have been saying that for months. Nothing is more important than right now making sure that people are healthy and people are safe. The other thing that's here, Dennis, and I'm sure we may get into this a little later, but what we saw in Gwinnett County was hundreds of demonstrators honking their horns at the Gwinnett County School Board and School Board Administration to basically protest against their approach of putting kids back in the classroom. The parents that I've talked to, it's two conversations I have. You have those working families that, quite frankly, need to work. If you can safely put your child in a school and you can go work, then yes, that helps the family. But then you're also talking to parents who have the means and have the resources at their disposal to fully commit to virtual learning. But I've also talked to a parent who had a child who failed the 11th grade because, quite frankly, this student cannot learn the way that he needs to in a virtual learning capacity. So he needs to be in a classroom. He needs to be with his peers. He needs to have that one-on-one interaction with teachers. And so this is what I propose. I think every single school system in the state of Georgia should extend virtual learning until we not only take more social responsibility and social distancing, but also give the state and the local governments and the school boards an opportunity to come up with a plan. Because right now, Dennis, we do not have a plan to make sure, not if, but when the virus spreads into these school systems, how do we make sure that it doesn't spread to a point where we have to shut the entire school systems down across the state of Georgia?
Yeah, I have a fear about that too, Theron, of that happening. And I think in some cases it's going to happen. And that's why I'm so confused about the lack of mandates about wearing masks in school when kids are put together. I mean, they are told to wear masks on buses, which makes sense. But then they're in these crowded hallways and nobody's wearing them. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Doesn't that kind of planning have to come in order for the state to bring its overall numbers down? Doesn't that have to come from a centralized, at least, direction? Even if implementation is left to the local districts, don't you have to have a plan that puts everybody in the same direction?
Well,
yes. Yeah, you do, Dennis. And one thing, Brian, let me agree real quick, because again, I don't want to take up too much more time. But let's go to the heart of this issue, right? We have the president of the United States of America, Dennis. Had he not been corrected, this president went on national television and basically said that children are immune, particularly young students are immune from the coronavirus, right? One thing about this podcast, let's just keep it real. There are, and it's not a racial thing, so I'm not, you know, it's black kids, Asian kids, Hispanic kids, and white kids. But there is this sentiment out there that, okay, if you get coronavirus, you'll live. I'm young, I'm 12, I'm 16, I'll get over it. And actually, I don't see the fear. I don't see the students being scared like they should that this is bad. And what the students don't understand is that if you catch it in school and bring it back to your home and give it to your mother or your father or your grandparents, they can die. And I think that's how direct we've got to be with these students.
I agree. Amen, brother. I agree with all of that.
5 months into the pandemic now, guys, Georgia's testing is still well short of what's needed to meet demand. We still have long waiting lines. The governor is turning to a new private provider to help add thousands of new tests per day. But Brian, Governor Kemp said the private labs were caught off guard by the spike in cases that we've seen recently, and they had already scaled back a bit. But this was entirely predictable if you reopen the way he did, and you can make an economic case for that. Wouldn't it also be pretty obvious that cases would go up? So how can anybody be caught off guard by this?
I don't think anybody really can look 2 weeks into the future and say that they know. It has been changing over time. And I will say that over time, we have obviously increased our capacity. We have done a lot more testing. It's a lot more available. What we hear about are the long lines. We hear about the long wait times to get your test results back. But for many Georgians, the access and turnover time has actually gotten to be much better. That work's still far from done, still much more to be done, but I still think we're making progress.
Dennis, we knew 3, 4, 5 months ago, Brian and I were talking about what the medical experts were saying in September, October, November, right? Once the curve is flattened, then we should expect for the numbers to spike up then. We're in August. So to say that we didn't know that we were going to have an increase of people who need to get tested, just use the mayor as an example, right? The mayor of Atlanta, Georgia, who has access to a lot of different people and a lot of different organizations, had to wait 14 days roughly to get her test results back. Can you imagine, Dennis, had she been able to go directly to a hospital or have a private test provider, a company that can get it back to her in 48 hours? Imagine how many other families are out there just like her. And then the other thing is to attack this whole argument about the economy, right? Okay, let's say someone thinks that they have coronavirus and they show symptoms. They take the test on a Monday. They literally have to quarantine themselves. And unless they have a job that would allow them to virtually perform their duties, they can't go to work. And so this whole thing about, well, we're doing our best and we're trying to get more tests and we're trying to figure out how to do it faster. That's one of the ways that you can help regrow the economy is bring in private partners that are doing this every day. And then the other thing is this, Dennis, we can't leave this out. If you bring in these private providers, not all of them, but some of them, it's anywhere between $100 to $160 per test. And at a time when we know that people are still waiting to get their unemployment insurance benefits, at a time we know that people are out of work, $160 for a family of four, I mean, they probably can't afford it. So they're forced to take the free testing that's provided to them and wait in a long line, probably run out of gas and waiting in line to get the free test. But then you have to wait 14 days to get it back. The one thing that I think that the governor has an opportunity to do here, and he's doing it, he's heading in the right direction, is to start back up the press conferences, do them daily or every other day. Talk about how you've opened the World Congress Center. I know Brian is on the board there. That was a great move on his part. But let's also know that he's reopened the World Congress Center because he knows that we're about to have another spike in that hospitalization and hospital beds are not available. And so I just think that he's got to come out and encourage more private partners to get involved so we can get the testing done, but also decrease the amount of time it takes for people to get their results.
And Brian, more than 2,100 physicians, disease experts, and healthcare workers sent a letter to Governor Kemp saying, here are some things you can do to help decrease any coming spike as we head into the fall and the regular flu season. And they said the first step would be a statewide mask mandate. Now, we talked about this just a minute ago when it came to kids and being indoors. What would be the political risk for the governor, if any, in saying, let's have a statewide mask mandate, at least indoors, or at least let local jurisdictions do that?
Well, the political risk is the accusations of a flip-flop. I mean, he's been very certain and very firm on the fact that a mandate is unenforceable. And he's right.
Mississippi's governor changed his mind.
Yeah, he did. And let's see how many people actually get pulled over for walking down the sidewalk and fined $500 or whatever the fine is in Mississippi. I would imagine it's going to be the same as in the municipalities in Georgia that did try to enact those ordinances where there's no record of anybody being fined. Again, what must happen in order for this to work is not a mandate, is for people to act responsibly. I don't know what more a mandate could do in these parts of Metro Atlanta where people have adopted these new standards. So I'm not quite sure what the mandate would do on a practical level.
Yeah, I think the mandate is where we're headed. It's how you present it. Now, let me be very honest. If Governor Kemp went out by himself and said that I'm going to mandate that everyone in the state of Georgia wear a mask, that's not the right way you should package it. What the governor could do, and I know this probably won't happen, but what if the governor went out, Brian, with Mayor Bottoms, with the new head of the state patrol, and also maybe the head of the GBI, and one other, you know, sort of a health official. If the five of them came out and made the case that we're going to do a temporary mask mandate statewide for 30 to 60 days, I just don't think the governor alone can make the announcement. He would have to bring in local municipalities. And I think that other person we would definitely need a part of this is a statewide school superintendent or someone from the teachers association or whatever. Now, as far as enforcement, yeah, you are going to have some people who are going to push back, right? But at the end of the day, I believe Georgians are at a point now, guys, where we really are like, okay, shame on you, Mr. or Mrs. whomever, if you are going to slow down my ability to put my kids back in school, to go to work, and to be able to live in this new norm if you refuse to wear a mask. I think if we approach it that way, it will get some pushback, but I think ultimately most Georgians will comply with that strategy.
In other words, the psychological effect, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the psychological effect, and not putting this governor out here who's already said that he's not going to do a mask mandate. But if he changed his mind, it's not that he's changing it himself so he doesn't get the political blowback from his base. He can say, after consulting with so many other individuals, collectively, we as Georgians are coming out together to put in this temporary mask mandate for 30 days. And then this will be the direct result of that mandate with the numbers.
Yeah, I understand what they're saying. It's very practical. That's not going to happen. I mean, for the governor to appear with those mayors when they've had this public battle over mask mandates, it would look politically like he's caved to them. Like they were right, he was wrong. So,
I said, though, not just maybe one mayor, maybe someone from the Georgia Municipal Association, right?
Yeah.
Because it's all about local control, Brian. And I know you support local control. You're one of those lasting Republicans because you are a true conservative with conservative values. And you believe in local control. Maybe not Mayor Bottoms.
What a setup right, this is. Yeah. Oh, right. God.
But if you could have someone from the Georgia Municipal Association, superintendents. And remember, I said the GBI, I said the State Patrol, Sheriff Association, if you had all those individuals come out collectively and have them package it together, I believe Georgians will buy in. I do.
Yeah. Well, you know, here's the thing. I largely agree with Governor Kemp's leadership on these issues. I share the sentiments that we had to save businesses and prevent the ruin of many people who had put their life savings into growing their businesses. And I'm with him on getting kids back in school. Where I have daylight with the governor is on local control over mask mandates. And I have said that consistently. And I think it was one misstep in all of this because it messed up the messaging. It took away the messaging about what he was doing to save businesses. It became the headlines. And it took away from the very proactive messaging he was doing, encouraging mask use voluntarily. He's been very good about that. I mean, he's done it consistently. When you see him out now, he's always in a mask. The image is right. The visual is what it needs to be. He's been very responsible about that. So I would like to see municipalities have the right to have a mask mandate, even though I don't think that they are enforceable. I think the governor is right about that. I think it's more about the law as a teacher, right? The law is a guideline in that way. And even if it's not enforceable, that gives cover to these business owners so that it's not them enforcing it, it's the government. And I think there's some good in that.
On a related note, this week, Gwinnett County resumed in-person hearings on evictions. DeKalb resumed virtual hearings, with Fulton soon to follow. And we, at least as we speak, still without the resumption of the weekly $600 unemployment benefits from the feds that expired just recently. So if that continues, there are going to be a lot more evictions. Theron, cities and counties are just not ready for this, are they?
Dennis, I'm so glad that we're talking about this. I had the very fortunate opportunity to talk to the Fulton County Marshal, Maria McKee. And what she shared with me, Dennis, she said, you know, in your podcast and on your many networks, you need to let people Fulton County know that we are about to start evicting people again. And for those who are listening that are going through some tough times right now, just know that you need to make sure that you check your email, make sure you can go to your county's website to figure out what are the things that you can do virtually to apply for an extension. You can also contest your eviction notice. And if you had those eviction notices come to you, whether they were on your door or they were sent to you through the mail or email, do not ignore them, because I don't want anyone who's listening to this podcast to receive a knock at the door and basically be evicted because you thought that the evictions sort of being put on hold was extended. It is in effect, and particularly in those counties that you mentioned, Dennis, everyone needs to take this very seriously. Now, there is an attempt with the Fulton County Marshal told me, because this is why we're getting this information out to our listeners, that if you are in an appeals phase or you feel that it's not right or you feel that there's something that you want to contest, go ahead and proactively do that. But I just want to particularly say to the people in Fulton County that the Atlanta Eviction Data Collective group and all the different people who are involved in this do not want to evict you if you can pay your rent, if you can actually get caught up. But if you can't, please, please contact them immediately and make sure you check your mail and check your emails. And if you're going to contest it or if you want to basically try to appeal it, make sure you do that now. In Fulton County, evictions will start on August 13th. So for our listeners, you got a little less than a week to make sure you go to www.magistratefulton.org or go to www.fultoncountyga.gov and put in your address and check and make sure if you, during the week of July 20th, if you should have received a notice or an update, but they will begin evictions in Fulton County on August 13th.
Theron, before Brian responds here, are cities and counties ready for what could be a wave of evictions because there's such a backlog?
No, that is the challenge here. What I did hear from this Fulton County Marshal is that they are communicating with cities to make sure that they get the word out, but I don't think we are ready for it. I mean, there's a call from a lot of local officials to say that we need another rent and mortgage freeze, particularly for homeowners who can't afford to pay their mortgages or pay their rent. I just think that this is something that is on the horizon that we need to make sure that we get out to the public that they need to be mindful of.
This could be a devastating fall when this begins to happen. And it's something that I kind of see from all perspectives, because while I feel greatly for these families that are losing their homes because they've lost their jobs in this sharp economic downturn, you know, I'm also a landlord. When all of this struck, I was like, so what happens if my tenants lose their jobs? The mortgage that I have to pay on that condo continues to demand money from me. So it's not just a matter of, you know, landlords who are heartless and not caring about these families. There's larger economic forces at work, and they don't really have a lot of choice. And I know that in many cases, many have tried to be compassionate and do everything they can to understand and meet the needs of their tenants who have lost their jobs. I don't know what kind of government programs we could put in place. I do know that back during the Great Recession, there was a federal effort because, you know, back then that was a mortgage crisis that sort of set all this off to begin with, that helped people keep their homes. So I think in order to avoid having just widespread evictions, and then where do those people go? So this is something that's going to take a federal approach because the states and localities don't have any money right now. On the front page of AJC on Thursday, you've got Speaker Ralston saying, Congress, please pass a $500 billion rescue package for the states because the states don't have any money. The gas taxes aren't coming in because people are driving less. Income taxes are way down because fewer people have jobs. Sales taxes are down because fewer people are shopping. So we've got big problems. The only way to really fix it would be with some sort of federal solution. And right now, I don't think that we're going to get one because Democrats in Congress are much more interested in extending the economic pain to hurt Donald Trump than they are in coming together and compromising in any way. They are refusing to come to the table. They are insisting on the $600 a week unemployment, which, by the way, is hurting our economy to some degree because people aren't going back to work because of it. Now that's run out and the rubber's about to hit the road. And, you know, I think Pelosi wants people to not have that money and then take it out on Donald Trump. That's what I think.
There have been some economists that have come out and made the case that by giving these Americans what they need right now, which is this additional $600 a week, which will be the difference between someone having a roof over their head or being homeless, the difference between a child being fed at night and going hungry for 3 or 4 days. This is not something to go against President Trump. This is about putting the health and well-being and financial stability of the American people first. And so I think Democrats are on the right side of this issue. At the end of the day, if you're hurting right now and you need this federal assistance, it cuts through party lines. It cuts through racial barriers. I think at the end of the day, Democrats are, and the polling shows it, people are saying, please extend unemployment benefits. And let's mind you, we're going to have this conversation and make it partisan. You know, we have a labor commissioner right now who there are people, a press conference in Georgia this week, who still have not received their unemployment benefits. Now, to be fair to Commissioner Mark Butler, he has done a great job of communicating the amount of volume that was unanticipated that really forced his system to react pretty urgently. But if there are still people right now who after months have gone by that haven't gotten their unemployment insurance checks and they've been waiting on it for months and this is just the first wave, then that's unacceptable. And I think he needs to get out here and he needs to communicate with the public about how they can make sure that going forward in the second round that we hope will happen, that we still don't have people waiting to get unemployment benefits for over, you know, 2 or 3 months.
And a quick note to our listeners, at this point in taping the Political Breakfast episode, the batteries in the recorder at my end of things went away, so we had to switch my audio to our backup system, so you'll notice a little difference in audio quality from here on out. Our apologies for that. Let's go back to the Political Breakfast.
Real quickly, just to follow up on the argument that Brian made about Congress. Brian, isn't it true that the Democrats in the House passed a relief bill? It's been sitting in the Senate while Republicans debate among themselves. That's the question to you. And Theron, are Democrats served by taking a hard line in negotiations with the Senate and the White House? Brian, I'll start with you.
The package passed by the House is a $3 trillion package. And, you know, we've already added, what, $3 or $4 trillion to the national debt over the last few months. Now, I'm not saying we need to penny pinch. And here's the thing, Republicans aren't saying we need to penny pinch. We just need to be smart about how we spend this money. And Theron's right. Everybody wants there to be an extension of unemployment insurance, even Republicans. In fact, the White House offered to congressional Democrats a temporary extension of the $600 a week supplement that people have been getting, which has now expired, and the Democrats rejected it. And, you know, people's lives are on the line. Why not just do that temporary patch until we can come to another agreement, which I think at some juncture we will get to. But one thing that we've got to do between now and the end of the year is incentivize work. You know, we're hearing from small businesses, well, from many businesses, big and small, actually, that they can't get their workers to come back because they are making more with the supplement and their unemployment check than they were making in their jobs. That is a cataclysmic equation. Nobody's going to go back to work as long as they're making more doing nothing than they are going back to the job. What Republicans are trying to do, very logically, is bring down that supplement just a little bit to incentivize more people to get back into the workforce if jobs are available to them. And for many people, there are. For many people, there aren't. And we need to be compassionate for those people. Republicans have also looked at saying, hey, let's do a percentage of your last salary, like wherever you were before the crisis hit. That too would incentivize people to go back to work because we need people to be making more at work than on unemployment, or our economy is not going to get back on its feet. That's why the Democrats are being irresponsible. They're disincentivizing work. Republicans are trying to have a compassionate approach that doesn't keep people out of the workforce.
Look, one of the things that Brian just pointed out really quickly is something that Democrats have got to do. We cannot be put in a corner that all we want to do is just give our base and the American people federal assistance, right? That is, he's right. Majority of people, Republicans and Democrats, independents all agree. We've got to also have a message out there about what we're doing to incentivize people who are hiring their employees back. And more importantly, for them to be innovative, to bring on new employees based on this new norm of virtual reality. What we cannot do is just stay on the federal assistance. We've got to make sure that we as Democrats also talk about the amount of money that's been allocated, things that have been passed from the House that really has been there to protect small businesses and provide them with the assistance that they need. Again, Democrats are on the right side of this issue right now, but when President Trump gets ramped up and he starts talking about, you know, the American worker, worker families, those are the things that we need to anticipate that's going to come from the Republican Party. And we need to, you know, we need to highlight those incentives and those programs that we've been, you know, promoting the last few months.
Meanwhile, early voting is about to wrap up for the August 11th runoffs. There are already disputes about absentee by mail, and the campaigns roll on in the middle of a pandemic. We'll get into all of that when we return after a brief break. Stay right here.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
And we are back on the Political Breakfast. Thanks very much for staying with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare with Republican strategist Brian Robinson and Democratic strategist Theron Johnson. This was the final week of early voting for the August 11th runoffs in Georgia. Not nearly as many people voting as did in the June 9th primary, but that's pretty much normal. The vast majority of the early voters for the runoffs are using absentee by mail instead of going to an in-person early voting location. Brian, President Trump continues to trash absentee by mail, except in Florida, of course. But here in Georgia, with some of the hottest runoffs actually among Republicans, isn't he running the risk of turning off GOP voters he needs to get active and using voting by mail for November?
Yes. And it's something that I'm sure the Trump campaign is aware of, because the polling, I've seen polling on this here in Georgia, and you are seeing Republican voters, many of whom are 65 and older, showing distrust about voting by mail and wanting to vote in person. And that is in direct response to the messaging coming out of the White House. We absolutely need that Republican base to be voting by mail, particularly if they are in a vulnerable group. Now, I think we showed that during the primary, at least, that many Republicans will vote by mail, because they did. I mean, I'm a Republican. I voted by mail in my runoff here in DeKalb County. But we have to encourage people to vote by mail, because it's going to be an important part of this election.
Yeah, I totally agree with Brian. And what has changed now is, remember I said on this podcast a few months ago that how the Republicans took power in the state government, particularly in 2002, is that they just had a better absentee ballot program, better direct vote by mail program than Democrats did for a long time. I mean, we finally woke up in 2016 and 18 and figured out that we can get Democrats to vote by mail and absentee as well. And so at a time where we know we got so many important elections, I mean, Brian talks about DeKalb County, I mean, Fulton County runoff, we have the runoff for our sheriff, we have the runoff for our district attorney. This is something that's very interesting that the president is doing. I think he's already building the narrative from when he's defeated, and he's going to try to create this amount of outrage of why he was defeated. And that's why you see that messaging kind of coming out of the White House right now around his opposition on direct, you know, vote by mail or, you know, absentee voting as well.
I think a lot of what the president is saying, and I do think this gets lost in translation, which is why I'm not particularly crazy about the messaging on this, is he has said absentee voting is good. He said that in his tweets. He hasn't just, you know, singled out Florida, which he did do, but he's talking about absentee voting being different than vote by mail. And so the difference is, absentee voting, you have to request your ballot, and there's a procedure in place. There has to be some proactivity on the part of the voter, whereas vote by mail is the state just sends you your ballot and you send it in. It's much more of a passive process. So he wants people to have to make some effort to get their ballot. I think that's sort of the dividing line there. And you can agree or disagree, but that's kind of where it is.
Brian, the Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, sent out applications, not ballots, but applications for the June 9th primary. And the Secretary of State now has gone after DeKalb County, which has said it will mail absentee ballot, again, applications, to both active and non-active voters. Raffensperger says sending out the applications to non-active voters increases the risk of fraud. Theron, does he have a case here?
The thing that's so crazy about that is, and Brian knows that I've complimented Secretary of State Raffensperger, and I've been critical lately. And what I would say on this, and this is really, I think I'm right on this, why are you going against a county who's basically saying, we want to basically emulate what you did, which received some praise from Democrats and Republicans, and then ultimately with a debacle, I don't think he got the praise that he needed, but basically proactively sending out applications statewide to encourage people to vote absentee. But when you're an inactive voter, let's just describe for our listeners who don't know what an inactive voter is. That don't mean that you're dead. That don't mean that you're some fake person that don't exist. That means that you probably didn't vote in the last 2, 3, 4 elections, right? Because maybe you're just someone who only votes in presidential elections. And so let's hypothetically say that DeKalb County sends out these applications for absentee voting to inactive voters. That person, he or she, still has to provide the necessary documentation to when they send their absentee ballot back in. Or that person may be encouraged to go and vote in person. But even if they go and vote in person, then they still have to show the necessary ID to vote. And so I think where the Secretary of State is losing the battle here is either you're for giving people full access to vote and making sure you're expanding those opportunities, or you're not. And I think that up until this point, I think majority of people will say that this Secretary of State has been on the side of trying to do everything he can proactively to give people the opportunity to vote. And the last thing I believe is that the county is willing to pay for it. So unless the state is going to pay for it, I can really see his opposition. But if the county is willing to pay for the additional absentee ballot applications that would need to be sent out to these inactive voters, then let them do it.
I absolutely agree with the Secretary of State's position on this. What he is trying to do is to prevent fraud, to not make Georgia a target of these stories nationally, which has continued to go on unfairly, in my opinion. Take note of what he didn't say. He didn't say that the county shouldn't send applications to active voters. That's people like me. They know I live where I say I live. I vote in every election that we have. He's saying inactive voters. And that's not people who didn't vote June 9th or didn't vote in the 2018 general election, but otherwise are voters who live where they are registered to vote. No, most of those addresses on the inactive list are obsolete or inaccurate. So what it will be doing would be sending applications to people who don't live where they are registered to vote, or at least registered to vote on that particular list. They may have signed up to vote somewhere else by then, and it would invite fraud. And despite all of these efforts, and we are making efforts to prevent fraud, in the first round when those applications went out, we all were hearing stories from friends and family about households getting applications for people who didn't live there anymore or people who had died several years before. So taking measures, and I would say this is a modest measure to prevent fraud, to prevent applications going out to people who aren't allowed to vote, is smart and good guidance. And he's right. If we do that, if we send inactive voters, we will be inviting fraud.
Real quickly, Brian, records from the state's own elections board, as reported by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, show very few cases of any absentee ballot violation since 2015. So is the Secretary of State worried about a problem that doesn't exist here, especially since inactive voters are still eligible voters?
But they're not eligible voters if they have moved. They are not eligible right. voters if they have died. And that's what this is about, is making sure that those folks get taken off the rolls. Democrats love to talk about voter roll purges, right? Oh, hundreds of thousands of people have lost their right to vote. Malarkey. Many of those people who are being taken off the rolls are registered to vote at their new residence. Many of the people who are taken off have left the state. Many have died. It's an important mechanism to keep our voter rolls up to date, to prevent fraud, to make sure that the people who are legally eligible to vote don't have their votes canceled out by people who aren't allowed to vote, or at least not allowed to vote in the jurisdiction where they are. So this whole thing, it's not true. We know there are thousands of people registered to vote, and this is particularly true amongst apartment dwellers, that don't live where they're registered to vote.
Again, go back to my premise of what I said about Secretary of State. Up until this point, I believe that the voters of Georgia think that the Secretary of State has done everything he possibly can to proactively make sure that people have access to vote. When you start getting into this argument about fraud, then we automatically, as Democrats and just as voters, are going to position him more with the Trump narrative, right? And we know that the Trump narrative right now in Georgia with this whole voter fraud thing is just not something that people truly believe. Listen, if you get married or you get divorced, if you change your name and you've been voting under your new name or been voting at this new address, but never the system picked up that you're not at that old address anymore, then you're an inactive voter. But you're not inactive because you're just actively voting under a different name, or maybe you've moved to a different location, right? And so I think, again, as Brian mentioned, it's just very hard to kind of explain to people the difference between inactive and active. I think at the end of the day is all about giving the voter the opportunity, he or she, to vote. And yes, okay, if you're an active voter and you got an absentee ballot in a apartment that you used to live in 3 years ago, how would you know you got that absentee ballot application unless that homeowner said, hey, Theron, you know what? You got an absentee ballot here application, but I know you don't live here anymore. What do you want me to do with it? And I think I would say, you know what? No, it's fine. Don't worry about it. I'm voting now at my new address over in Decatur. And so I'm just going to go and do what I've been doing. And so I think at the end of the day, it's been very few cases of actual fraud, as you mentioned, Dennis. And then secondly, it's got to be about trusting the voters, knowing that people have good intentions when it comes to voting, and making sure that you give them all the access that they deserve to vote.
Speaking of voting, the issue of white supremacist messages, subtle and otherwise, were brought up by opponents of both of Georgia's U.S. senators. The campaign of Republican Senator David Perdue said he was not aware of a digital flyer that enlarged Democratic opponent John Ossoff's nose, included a photo of Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, and said the Democrats were trying to buy the election. Ossoff and Schumer are both Jewish. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Kelly Loeffler sat down for an interview with One America Network host Jack Posobiec, who has been criticized for past racist tweets, including some that included some code numbers used by neo-Nazis and for past ties with white supremacists. Brian, a couple of unforced errors here, or is this much ado about nothing?
Well, in the Perdue case, the campaign fired the digital vendor that did that image. The senator said they did not know about it. They did not approve that. That was not something that they find acceptable. So they didn't double down on this. They handled it appropriately and moved on. I take them at their word, and I think other people should as well, considering they took decisive action in the wake of that. Now, he's in a different situation, though, because he's in a general election. So he can kind of have a play to the middle. Senator Loeffler is in a fight in a special jungle election, and she is basically in a primary inside that jungle election with Doug Collins. And she must, in that scenario, be a fighter, be a conservative fighter, stand up to the cancel culture, stand up to the media attacks who accuse Republicans of racism for everything. I would bet you, because I'm a communications director who worked for elected officials and for candidates, they didn't know this guy had white supremacists or neo-Nazi ties or whatever. I don't Google and do deep background research on everybody that my clients get interviewed by. And I'd imagine the Loeffler team didn't either. A campaign is going a million miles a minute. As Theron, as a fellow campaign guy, knows, you don't have time for all of that due diligence. So I don't believe for a second that they knew that they were sitting down with somebody who was a white supremacist. Not at all. But in this atmosphere that she's in now, she couldn't bow to the media attacks. She had to kind of stand her ground and say, I'm not going to be canceled out by you guys.
Really quickly, Dennis. All right, let's just start with Senator Perdue. Senator Perdue firing the digital vendor was the right thing to do, and absolutely. But the damage is already done. I want to go on the record for saying that I'm going to defend John Ossoff right now. And Brian knows this. Not only am I defending John Ossoff because he's a friend, but I'm going to defend him because what the Perdue team put out or was put out on their behalf, which they did fire the vendor, was absolutely appalling. It is really what you know is left of some of the people that represent the grand old party. To blatantly appeal to the racism that exists and anti-Semitism of the worst of their supporters was something that the Republican Party has got to address. And I know that Senator Perdue fired this person, but these people do exist. And what we're talking about now is a lot of voters didn't even know John Ossoff was Jewish. Not something that he hides, not something that he promotes. I mean, it is who he is. But they know that a certain base of the Republican Party and some Democrats, but mostly the Republican Party, is something that's going to excite a race war. It is going to excite the anti-Semitism that exists. And I want to call that out. As far as Loeffler, I disagree a little bit with Brian. Whenever you go into an interview and you're running for U.S. Senate and you're a current U.S. Senator with millions and millions of dollars and a huge team, yes, you're supposed to make sure that you research and Google everyone who interviews your candidate. Now, maybe it didn't come up in the research. Maybe it didn't come up in the vet. But when you're at that level, you're not going to put your candidate, who is the current U.S. senator who's running to get elected, in a situation with a reporter. The other thing is this. She's now entered into what a cultural war. Instead of us talking about policy and the principles she stands for and all she wants to do for the people of Georgia, now she has entered into a race war at a time when she did come out and stand up for Black Lives Matter. She did speak out with Ahmaud Arbery. But now that's going to be totally questioned because you just sat down and did an interview with a white supremacist. And this is where I have to call out some of the people in my party, right? You know, where's the outrage on this? I mean, you know, you've seen a few people kind of do it. There's some Democrats that are on the flyer for Senator Loeffler. She has a big fundraiser that's coming up. I mean, a lot of Democrats that I know disagree with what this white supremacist stands for, but they're still going out and supporting her. And so this is something for both U.S. senators that I think they will ultimately have to get through and communicate with the people of Georgia. Two sort of different scenarios, but they're both are based on problems that exist with certain members of the Republican Party. Not all, not people like Brian, but there is this segment of the Republican Party right now that these two U.S. senators have got to figure out how they deal with.
Meanwhile, Governor Kemp signed the controversial Police Protection Bill, House Bill 838, creates a new criminal offense, biased, motivated intimidation of an officer or other first responder. Very quickly, Theron, this was part of a deal to get a separate hate crimes bill through the legislature and to the governor. One might not like the process or one might like it, but was it worth it from the point of view of Democrats to make that deal, even if it meant this bill, which they don't like, became law?
To be determined. I mean, there were groups that were out in force asking people to join them in the fight to encourage the governor to veto this police protection bill. Organizations like the NAACP, a lot of local activists and lawyers immediately came out and said, yes, you know, we got the hate crimes legislation, which is something that we knew was going to happen. It was just all about figuring out how to get it to a point where we can get it to the governor's desk and the language would be comfortable with everyone. But I think this is something that, you know, Democrats are going to have to answer to constituents about. But also, I think that Republicans are going to have to explain this law and how do you sort of walk that very tough balancing act between being for hate crimes legislation and being for police reform and community policing, but at the same time, defend some of the language and some of the law that's been put in place with this bill. And so this is something that I think that will be ongoing. We haven't heard the last of the people who really oppose the governor signing this legislation.
Brian, the governor heard from folks who said this, under some circumstances, might even reduce penalties for people who murder police officers. Did the governor feel, though, that politically he had no choice but to sign this one, even though some were urging him to wait and perfect it in the next session?
Now, I think a lot of people reject the interpretation that this would reduce penalties on those who hurt officers. Let's look at the atmosphere we were in June when they were back in session. There was tremendous pressure to get a hate crimes bill passed. Obviously, the speaker was putting a lot of lobbying effort on the Senate to get it through. And the lieutenant governor, Senator Bill Kowser, and others had to figure out a way to get the hate crimes bill through, making sure that there was a hate crimes protection for police officers. And this is at a time, and this is still going on for that matter, where people are watching the nightly news and they're seeing rioters attack police. And so you saw violence being perpetrated against police officers just because they were wearing a uniform. That was the atmosphere that we were in. And getting that bill, which was separated out from the hate crimes, onto the floor was the grease that it took to get the other hate crimes law through. And so everybody got a little bit of what they wanted. That's how the process works sometimes. I personally love the idea of adding penalties for those who attack police for no other reason than the fact that this is their job, the fact that they're wearing a badge. I think it sends a strong signal that we're not going to tolerate it. It sends a strong signal at a time when so many police officers feel under siege and under attack that we say to them, we appreciate what you're doing to protect our communities. We appreciate the risk that you take every day to protect us. So thank you. We're going to protect you.
And that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Theron Johnson is a Democratic strategist, a public affairs and government consultant, and former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Thanks so much to you both. All the best to your families.
Have a great weekend.
Please be safe and mask up.
And you can follow us on Twitter. Brian is at Lord Tinsdale. That's T-I-N-S-D-A-L-E. Theron is at Theron Johnson. And I'm at D-E-N-I-S-O-H-A-Y-E-R. Our thanks to Kevin Rinker and Stephen Key for their production assistance. And don't forget our podcast with all the up-to-the-minute information on the coronavirus. It's called Did You Wash Your Hands? Sam Whitehead is your host. And if you like this show, please subscribe, and you can do that wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to rate us. That's a great way to make sure other people can find us. We'll be back in your feed and in your head soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us, and have a great week.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WAB politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WAB politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WAB.org or your favorite podcast platform.